Welcome to the deep dive. Looks like we're taking a deep dive into privacy and machine learning today. You sent us some excerpts from privacy-preserving machine learning, and it looks like you're really trying to understand how we can benefit from machine learning without, giving up all our privacy.
Yeah, it's a really important topic. I mean, think about it.
It's a huge topic.
Our world runs on machine learning now. Like, seriously, how much data do you think you generate every day? Browsing history, fitness tracker data, all of it feeds into these powerful AI applications.
It's honestly mind-boggling. But the authors of this book, and they actually have experience with USOCOM and DARPA,
Oh, wow.
they say all this reliance on data comes with some risks. They use this phrase, learning beyond the intended purpose, which I thought was pretty thought-provoking.
Yeah, what they're getting at is that even seemingly harmless data can be analyzed in ways that reveal sensitive information that you never meant to share.
Like that whole Cambridge Analytica thing.
Exactly. Remember that personality quiz app on Facebook? It wasn't just collecting data from the people taking the quiz, but also from their friends. And then it was used for targeted political advertising without their consent.
It's scary to think about. It's almost like our data has a life of its own. The book then goes on to talk about different types of attacks on these machine learning systems.
And these aren't like the typical hacking attacks you hear about, someone breaking into a computer. These attacks exploit how machine learning models are trained and used to extract private information. Like, imagine this, someone using a machine learning model to actually recreate your fingerprint from the data that was used to train it.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it sounds crazy, right? The authors even cite research where someone could reconstruct raw gestural data from continuous authentication systems, like Face ID.
So, like, if that data gets into the wrong hands, you could be at risk of identity theft.
Exactly. That's one example. There's also something called a model inversion attack. Let's say someone has access to a model that's used to predict loan approvals. They could potentially use that model to work backward and figure out the financial details of the people whose data was used to train it.
Oh, wow. So even if you're not directly sharing your financial information, it could be inferred from the model's behavior.
Exactly. And then there's membership inference attack. This one is about figuring out if your data was part of the training set for a specific model. Even if the attacker doesn't actually know the specifics of your data, the fact that it was used in training could reveal something sensitive. Like, let's say a model is trained on data from people with a specific health condition. If an attacker can figure out that your data was in that set, they could infer that you have that condition.
Okay, now I'm officially creeped out. So how do we fight back against all these threats? Is that where privacy-preserving machine learning comes in?
You got it. PPML is all about figuring out techniques to minimize privacy risks while still, getting all the benefits of machine learning. The book outlines a few different approaches, different lines of defense, as they call it. One of them is privacy-preserving data collection.
Okay, what does that even mean?
So imagine you're filling out a survey about something kind of sensitive. Instead of answering directly, you could use a technique called randomized response. You flip a coin, and if it's heads, you answer truthfully. But if it's tails, you answer randomly.
Okay.
This way, you're adding noise to the data, making it hard to link your response directly to you. But if you have enough responses, researchers can still find statistically meaningful insights.
That's really clever. It's like protecting your privacy while still contributing to research. The book also mentions something called data publishing and processing as a line of defense. What's that all about?
So that's about protecting privacy when data needs to be shared, like let's say medical records being released for research.
Okay.
One way to do this is something called K-anonymity. It ensures that no single person can be identified from their data by grouping records together that have similar characteristics. So instead of releasing precise ages and zip codes, you could group people into broader age ranges or regions. This way, it's a lot harder to pin down any individual.
It's kind of like creating a fog around the data to make it harder to see individuals.
Exactly. And then another important area is protecting the output of data mining algorithms. Even if the data itself is protected, the results of the analysis could still reveal private information. Think about it like this. Imagine you're trying to put together a puzzle where the pieces are all scrambled up to protect privacy. Even if you can't see any individual piece clearly, you might still be able to figure out the overall image.
Oh, I see. So even if the individual data points are protected, the patterns in the results could still be revealing.
That's right. And the book mentions techniques like output perturbation, which adds noise to the results, making it harder to infer anything sensitive from them.
So you're basically masking the sensitive details, even in the results. From what I read, Differential privacy, or DP, seems to be a pretty big deal in this whole PPML thing. Am I right?
Absolutely. DP gives you a rigorous way to measure and control how much privacy is leaking out. Imagine you have two data sets, almost identical except for one person's data.
Okay, got it.
A DP algorithm guarantees that the results of any analysis on these two sets will be practically the same. This makes it really hard to figure out anything about that one person whose data is different.
So it's like having a shield around that person's data, making them harder to identify.
Exactly. And the strength of the shield is determined by a value called epsilon. Smaller epsilon means stronger privacy protection, but there's a catch. As you increase privacy, you might lose some accuracy in your machine learning models because of the added noise. It's all about finding the right balance.
So you're saying it's like trying to find the sweet spot between being invisible and still being able to get some useful information out of the data.
Exactly. The book also talks about local differential privacy, or LDP.
How is that different from regular DP?
So with DP, the data is all collected and then anonymized in one central place. But with LDP, each person anonymizes their own data before sharing it, which gives them even more control. It's like everyone having their own personal privacy shield.
Oh, I see. But doesn't that make it harder to analyze the data if everyone is scrambling it up in their own way?
It can be more challenging, but LDP is evolving quickly. The book mentions methods like randomized response, which we already talked about, histogram encoding, where you group data into buckets before adding noise, and something called Ducci's mechanism, which is a fancier way of adding noise. These are all ways to add noise while still keeping the data useful for analysis.
So it's like scrambling the individual pieces without ruining the whole puzzle.
Exactly. It's a really cool area of research.
You know, all of this is super informative, but what really caught my eye was this idea of compressive privacy. It sounds like a really clever way to protect privacy and make the data more manageable for machine learning all at the same time.
It's a pretty innovative approach, yeah. It uses the idea of data compression, like how you compress images or audio files to make them smaller. You shrink the data down, but you still keep the important information for machine learning.
So you're basically squeezing out the irrelevant parts while keeping the good stuff.
Exactly. And by reducing the size of the data, you're automatically reducing the amount of information that could be used to identify people. It's a win-win. And the cool part is that it does this in a smart way. It prioritizes the features that are most important for the machine learning task.
So it's not just blindly compressing everything, it's more targeted. The book had this case study using facial recognition and something called DCA.
Discriminant Component Analysis, yeah. It's similar to PCA, Principal Component Analysis, which is a common way to reduce the dimensions of data. But PCA focuses on keeping the variation in the data, while DCA is designed for tasks like classification. It tries to find the features that best separate different classes of data.
So in the face recognition example, PCA might find the features that capture the most general variation in faces, while DCA would focus on the features that best distinguish between different faces.
Precisely. In the case study, they used DCA to compress facial image data, and they still got really good accuracy in facial recognition.
That's impressive. It really does seem like you get the best of both worlds with compressive privacy. You get the privacy benefits from compression and better efficiency in machine learning.
It's a promising area, and the book suggests it could be used in a bunch of different machine learning areas. Definitely something to keep an eye on.
Okay, so we've talked about protecting privacy during data collection and processing. What about when you have these massive data sets spread across different places, like in a research project with multiple collaborators? I remember the book had a case study about that, focusing on doing PCA and DCA in a way that preserves privacy, even when the data is distributed.
Right. That's a really relevant problem these days. Data is often siloed in different organizations. Like, think about researchers from different hospitals who want to analyze patient data together.
But they can't just pool all their data in one place because of privacy concerns.
Exactly. It's like each hospital has a piece of a puzzle, but they can't just combine all the pieces directly.
So how do they solve that problem?
Well, this case study proposes a really clever protocol that lets multiple parties do PCA or DCA together on their combined data without actually revealing their individual data sets to each other.
So they can work with a larger, more complete data set and still keep everything private.
Exactly. They use some pretty sophisticated techniques like homomorphic encryption and garbled circuits.
I've heard those terms before, but can you remind me what they are?
Sure. Homomorphic encryption is a special kind of encryption that lets you do calculations on encrypted data without decrypting it first. It's like having data locked in a box and you want to do math with it without opening the box.
Wow. So you can manipulate the data without ever actually seeing it.
You got it. And then you have garbled circuits, which let multiple parties compute a function together without revealing their individual inputs.
So how do they all fit together in this privacy-preserving PCA-DCA protocol?
Basically, each party computes their own part of the PCA or DCA calculation using their local data. Then they send these encrypted shares to a central coordinator. The coordinator uses homomorphic encryption to combine these shares and get the final result, all without ever seeing the raw data from each party.
So it's like each party contributes to the recipe without revealing their secret ingredients.
Exactly. And the cool thing is that this case study showed that it's not only good at protecting privacy, but it's also efficient, so it could actually work in real-world collaborations.
This is amazing. It's like cryptography and data science are teaming up to solve these really tough privacy problems.
It really is.
This whole idea of collaborative data analysis while preserving privacy, it's a game changer. But all this is very theoretical. Are there any real-world systems that actually use these techniques? I know the book mentions a platform called Data Hub.
Yes. It's a conceptual framework, but it shows how you could design a system that lets researchers securely share and analyze data while making sure everything stays private and complies with regulations like IPAL, which protects health information.
So it's kind of like a secure sandbox where researchers can play with data without breaking any privacy rules.
I like that analogy. Data Hub aims to provide a safe space for collaborative analysis, where researchers can make discoveries while protecting individual privacy.
That's so important, especially with all the concerns about data breaches and privacy violations these days. Can you tell me more about how Data Hub achieves this level of security and privacy? What are some of its key features?
Well, it takes a multi-layered approach. One key part is secure data storage. It uses a framework called SEC NoSQL, which encrypts the data and verifies its integrity to protect it even when it's just sitting there on the servers.
So even if someone unauthorized managed to access the servers, the data itself would be unreadable.
Exactly. Think of it like multiple layers of security around a vault.
That's reassuring. But what about when researchers need to actually access and analyze the data? How does Data Hub protect privacy during those activities?
Data Hub has a strict access control system to make sure only authorized users can see specific data sets. It uses a role-based access control model, so permissions are given based on a person's role in the system.
So instead of giving everyone access to everything, it restricts access based on who you are and what you need to do. Makes sense. But just having access control doesn't really guarantee privacy during the analysis, right? What else does Data Hub do to protect privacy during that phase?
That's where all these privacy-preserving machine learning techniques we've been discussing come in. Data Hub incorporates algorithms like that differentially private PCA and DCA protocol we talked about. This way, researchers can do their analysis and get the insights they need without compromising anyone's privacy.
So they can do their work, get their results, and feel confident they're not accidentally leaking sensitive information.
Precisely. Data Hub makes privacy-preserving analysis a natural part of the research process.
That's really cool. But what if researchers want to do more exploratory analysis where there might not be predefined privacy-preserving algorithms? Does Data Hub have anything for those situations?
It does. That's where synthetic data generation comes in. Data Hub can generate synthetic data sets that statistically resemble the original data, but don't contain any actual individual records. Researchers can use these synthetic data sets to experiment and explore without touching the real sensitive data.
So it's like giving them a safe playground where they can try things out without worrying about accidentally causing any privacy harm.
Exactly. Data Hub empowers researchers to explore new ideas while promoting responsible and ethical data handling.
Data Hub sounds like a really well-designed platform. It really embodies the whole idea of privacy-preserving machine learning.
It does. And even though it's still in the conceptual stage, it shows how you could design a system to enable data-driven innovation while respecting privacy. It's a vision of a future where collaboration and data sharing can thrive without compromising people's right to privacy.
That's a future we can all get behind. Now, we've talked a lot about Epsilon and privacy budgets, but can you explain what a privacy budget actually is in a practical sense? How does it work?
Sure. A privacy budget is like a limited resource that you have to use carefully. Every time you do a query or an analysis on a data set using a differentially private algorithm, you use up a little bit of your privacy budget.
So it's like having a certain amount of money you can spend, and each query has a price tag.
That's a good way to think about it. And the price of a query depends on how sensitive it is. Queries that could reveal more about individuals cost more of your budget. For example, asking for someone's exact age would cost more than asking for their age range.
So there's like a sliding scale based on how much information could be revealed. So does that mean once you use up your privacy budget, you can't ask any more questions?
Yeah, that's right. As you keep querying the data, your privacy budget shrinks. And once it's gone, you can't ask any more questions without risking a privacy breach. It's like hitting your spending limit on your credit card. You have to be smart about how you use it.
It sounds like setting the right privacy budget is really important.
Absolutely. If you set it too small, you might not be able to get the information you need. But if it's too big, you risk compromising privacy. It depends on a lot of factors, like how sensitive the data is, what you want to use it for, and how much privacy protection you need.
It sounds like careful planning is crucial for using data responsibly and ethically. It's not just about jumping in and asking whatever you want. You have to think strategically about every step.
You're exactly right. And the good news is that there are tools and techniques being developed to help people figure out good privacy budgets for their needs.
That's good to hear. It seems like a lot of research is happening in this area, which is encouraging. Okay, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I wanted to touch on one more thing. Secure Multi-Party Computation, or SMPC. Can you tell me what that is?
SMPC is a really interesting area of cryptography that lets multiple parties compute a function on their data together without anyone having to reveal their individual data to the others. Imagine a group of people who want to figure out their average salary without anyone having to say what their own salary is.
Oh, I see. That sounds really useful when you're dealing with sensitive information.
Right. And one way to do this is with a technique called secret sharing. It's like you have a secret message and you split it up between several people. Each person gets a piece and none of them can figure out the full message on their own.
Uh-huh.
Only when they put all the pieces together can they see the original message.
And so going back to that salary example, each person would split their salary into pieces, give those pieces to everyone else, and then they'd all do some calculations on their pieces.
Exactly. And in the end, they would know the average salary without anyone having to reveal their own salary. Now imagine this applied to machine learning. Let's say you have multiple hospitals that want to train a machine learning model together on their combined data, but they can't share their actual patient records.
So they could use SMPC to train the model without revealing their private data.
Exactly. It could be used in different stages of the machine learning process. It's a powerful technique that's becoming more popular, especially in areas like healthcare and finance, where privacy is super important, but people still need to work together.
It sounds like SMPC has the potential to really change how we do collaborative data analysis, especially when we're dealing with sensitive information.
I think so too. It's just another example of how creative people are getting in this field of privacy preserving machine learning.
Okay, we've been focusing on the technical stuff, but we can't forget about the people involved, right?
Mm.
At the end of the day, it's people who decide how data is collected, used, and protected.
You're absolutely right. We can have all the fancy algorithms in the world, but if people aren't using them responsibly, privacy is still at risk.
So what are some things we need to think about when it comes to the human side of privacy preserving machine learning?
Well, one really important thing is awareness and education. Anyone working with sensitive data needs to understand the risks and the ethical issues involved. They need the knowledge and skills to make good decisions about how the data is used.
It's like that saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly. And it's not just about technical knowledge. It's about building a culture of privacy and ethical data handling within organizations.
So creating an environment where people value privacy and feel comfortable speaking up if they see something that's not right.
Precisely. Open communication and a shared sense of responsibility are really important. We also need to think about the role of regulations and policies. Governments need to set standards for data privacy, hold organizations accountable, and make sure these powerful technologies are used responsibly.
It's about having laws and regulations that ensure organizations are actually using these privacy-preserving techniques and that individuals have some recourse if their privacy is violated.
Exactly. We're starting to see some progress in that area. For example, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, in Europe and the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA, in the United States, those are really important steps toward recognizing and protecting data privacy.
It's good to know that the importance of data privacy is being acknowledged and that there are efforts to establish guidelines and protections.
It's definitely encouraging. And remember, technology isn't inherently good or bad. It's just a tool. It's up to us to use it in a way that benefits everyone.
This conversation has really shown me how interconnected technology, ethics, and society are. We can't just focus on the technical stuff. We need to think about the bigger picture and make sure we're using these tools responsibly.
I completely agree. It's all connected.
So before we move on, I wanted to touch on something you've been researching, the connection between privacy and fairness in machine learning.
Well, that's a topic I'm really passionate about. For a long time, the main focus in machine learning was just accuracy, making models that can predict things correctly. But people are starting to realize that accuracy isn't the only thing that matters. We also need to think about fairness and the ethical implications of our models.
So it's not just about whether a machine can do something, but whether it should.
Exactly. The book highlights how closely linked privacy and fairness are in machine learning. It talks about how even anonymization, which is meant to protect privacy, can sometimes accidentally make things unfair.
How does that happen?
Imagine you're building a model to predict loan approvals, and you try to protect privacy by removing names and other obvious identifiers from the data. But let's say the data still has zip codes. And what if those zip codes are strongly correlated with race or income level?
So even though you've removed some identifiers, the model could still indirectly discriminate against people from certain areas.
That's right. It could mean that people from certain areas are less likely to be approved for a loan, even if they are just as qualified as someone from a different area.
Wow. That's a great example of how even when you try to do the right thing, you have to be very careful about unintended consequences.
Exactly. And luckily, the book goes into ways to address these risks and build machine learning models that are both private and fair. One way is to use pre-processing techniques that help remove or reduce biases from the data before you even train the model.
So you're kind of leveling the playing field before the game even starts.
Exactly. Another approach is to use algorithms that are specifically designed to be fair. These fairness-aware algorithms consider fairness as a goal during the training process itself, not just as an afterthought. They can have built-in constraints to prevent them from discriminating based on certain attributes.
So it's about baking fairness into the very core of the model.
Precisely. And the book does a really good job of explaining these concepts and challenges, reminding us that as our models become more powerful, we need to be more thoughtful about their impact on society.
It's really encouraging to see how much thought is going into these areas. Mm-hmm. This whole deep dive has really opened my eyes to just how complex the world of privacy is, mm-hmm. especially with machine learning. There are so many different techniques and approaches, it's almost overwhelming.
It can definitely be a lot to take in.
Does the book offer any guidance on how to choose the best privacy-preserving techniques for a particular situation?
It does. They have a decision-making framework you can use. It takes into account things like the type of data you're dealing with, how sensitive it is, what you want to use it for, the level of protection you need, and the resources you have available.
So it's kind of a checklist to help you narrow down the options to the ones that make the most sense for your specific situation.
That's a great way to put it. It helps you evaluate your needs and constraints systematically.
That's super useful. It's like having a guide to navigate through all the options. But all of this is still very theoretical. Mm-hmm. Are there any actual software tools or platforms out there that people can use to put these techniques into practice?
Absolutely. There are a lot of tools and resources becoming available, and the book mentions several popular libraries. One of them is called TensorFlow Privacy, which builds on the popular TensorFlow framework.
I've heard of TensorFlow. It's a widely used framework for machine learning. So how is this privacy-focused version different?
TensorFlow Privacy gives you tools and techniques to implement differential privacy in TensorFlow models. You can add DP to your models without needing to become a cryptography expert.
So it's like a privacy layer on top of TensorFlow.
Exactly. It makes it easier to build models that protect privacy. And there are other libraries too. One called PySift focuses on secure and private deep learning using techniques like federated learning and differential privacy.
Federated learning, what's that?
In federated learning, multiple parties can train a model together on all of their data without actually sharing their raw data with each other. It's a decentralized way to do machine learning.
So it's like those collaborative PCA and DCA protocols we talked about, but instead of calculating PCA or DCA, You're actually training a whole machine learning model.
Precisely. It's really useful in fields like healthcare and finance, where data privacy is critical, but collaboration is also essential.
It sounds like a lot of work is going into making these techniques easier for people to use.
Yes. And it's not just software libraries. There are also platforms being developed that provide complete solutions for privacy-preserving machine learning, like that Data Hub platform we discussed earlier.
So we have libraries for building models and platforms for managing data and analysis. It's like a whole ecosystem is emerging around this.
Exactly. And as the field grows, we can expect even more sophisticated tools and resources to support privacy-preserving machine learning applications. It's a very exciting time to be involved in this area.
This deep dive has really opened my eyes to how much potential there is in this field.
I agree.
It's inspiring to see how people are finding innovative ways to protect privacy in the age of big data and AI.
Absolutely. It shows how we can use our creativity to balance progress with our values.
Before we move on to the next part, I'm curious, what do you think is next for privacy-preserving machine learning? What trends and challenges do you see on the horizon?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest trends is going to be integrating privacy-preserving techniques into mainstream machine learning. As more and more people become aware of privacy concerns, we're going to see these techniques becoming standard features and tools and platforms, making it easier to build privacy into systems from the very beginning.
So instead of being an afterthought, privacy will become a core part of how machine learning is done.
Exactly. It's about shifting from reacting to privacy problems after they happen to building privacy in from the start.
I like that. So baking privacy into the recipe.
Yes. I also think we'll see the development of standardized ways to measure and evaluate privacy. Right now, it's a bit of a mess, with different techniques using different metrics. It's hard to compare things.
So having a common language for privacy would be really helpful.
Absolutely. It would make it easier to understand what level of protection different techniques offer and make informed decisions. And thankfully, a lot of research groups are working on this. I think we'll see big strides in this area in the coming years, which will be key for building trust and making sure things are transparent.
That makes a lot of sense. But with all this progress, there must be some challenges too, right?
Oh, definitely. One of the biggest challenges is keeping up with how fast things are changing in data science and AI. New machine learning techniques are coming out all the time, and we need new privacy-preserving techniques to keep up.
So it's a constant race to stay ahead of the curve.
Exactly. And this means researchers in machine learning and those working on privacy and security need to work together closely. Another challenge is communicating about all of this effectively. We need to explain these techniques to the public and to policymakers so they understand what's going on and can make informed decisions about things like regulations.
So it's not just about the technology. It's about building understanding and trust around that technology.
Exactly. We need to have open discussions so we can all work together to make sure these technologies are developed and used ethically and responsibly.
This has been a really insightful conversation. It's clear that privacy-preserving machine learning isn't just a technical field. It's also about ethics and how we want to live in a data-driven world.
Absolutely. It's about finding ways to use data to make our lives better while respecting people's rights and values.
Okay, before we move on to the next part, one last question. Are you generally optimistic about the future of privacy in this data-driven world, or are you more concerned?
That's a tough one. I'd say I'm cautiously optimistic. I think the growing awareness of privacy and the demand for technologies that protect privacy are really good signs. People are starting to realize that their data has value and that they have a right to control how it's used.
So we're waking up to the importance of privacy in the digital age.
I think so, yeah. And this is going to push innovation and lead to better data practices. But, you know, it's hard not to be a little worried sometimes considering how much data is being collected and the potential for misuse. I get it. It's a valid concern. But I think the key thing to remember is that technology itself isn't good or bad. It's just a tool. It's up to us to use it the right way. With smart solutions, good policies, and a society that cares about privacy, I think we can create a future where data is used to benefit us without compromising our fundamental rights.
That's a future worth fighting for. Okay, so we've talked about the future of the field in general, but you mentioned that the book also points to some exciting new areas for research. Where do you see the biggest opportunities for innovation in privacy-preserving machine learning going forward?
One area with huge potential is developing new cryptographic techniques. We've talked about homomorphic encryption and garbled circuits, but there are a lot of other tools in cryptography that could be used for privacy, and researchers are exploring those possibilities.
So we're talking about pushing the boundaries of cryptography to find even better ways to protect data in machine learning.
Exactly. And it's not just about creating new techniques. It's also about making existing ones more efficient so they can actually be used in real-world applications.
Because sometimes those complex cryptographic methods can really slow things down, right?
That's right. So figuring out how to make them work faster and at a larger scale is super important if we want people to actually use them. Another promising area is developing more robust privacy frameworks. Differential privacy is great, but it's not a magic bullet, and we need other tools as well.
So we need to expand our toolkit to cover more situations and offer more nuanced and flexible privacy protection.
Exactly. It's also about figuring out how to integrate these frameworks into existing machine learning workflows and building tools that are easy for developers to use.
Because a framework is only as good as its implementation.
You got it. And this is where collaboration between researchers and the industry is really important. We need to work together to turn these theoretical ideas into practical tools that people can use in their everyday work.
This collaborative approach seems to be a theme in this field.
It is.
Are there any other research areas that you're particularly excited about?
I'm really interested in how privacy-preserving machine learning can work with other new technologies like blockchain and edge computing. For example, blockchain's decentralized nature could be used to increase transparency and accountability in privacy-preserving systems.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, imagine if you could track how data is being used and ensure compliance with privacy regulations by recording things on a blockchain. That would be amazing.
Exactly. And then there's edge computing, where you process data closer to where it's generated, which means less data needs to be sent to central servers, making it harder for someone to steal it.
So instead of sending your sensitive health data to some company's cloud, your phone could process some of it locally.
Precisely. There are so many exciting possibilities when you combine privacy-preserving machine learning with these emerging technologies.
It really does feel like we're at the beginning of something big, like we're on the verge of a new era in data science, where privacy is not an afterthought, but a fundamental value.
I agree. I think we have the power to shape the future of data and AI in a way that benefits everyone, while protecting individual rights. It's going to take collaboration, creativity, and a commitment to ethical principles, but I think it's definitely worth it.
Well said. I think that's a perfect place to pause for now. When we come back, we'll look at some specific real-world examples of how these techniques are being used and explore what we can all do to protect our own privacy in this data-driven world. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been talking about the fascinating world of privacy-preserving machine learning, and I'm excited to keep going.
Me too. It's been a great conversation. We've covered so much, from understanding the threats to privacy in this age of big data to exploring all the amazing techniques that are being developed to address those threats.
Exactly. We've talked about things like differential privacy, compressive privacy, and even dipped our toes into cryptography with homomorphic encryption and secure multi-party computation. It's incredible how people are coming up with such clever solutions to protect privacy.
It really is. And it shows just how important it is for people from different fields to work together. You have computer scientists, cryptographers, statisticians, ethicists, legal experts. They're all coming together to figure out how to solve these complicated problems.
It's a real team effort. And this collaboration is already leading to some exciting real-world applications. We talked about the Data Hub platform earlier, which is a perfect example of how these privacy-preserving techniques can be built into a system designed for secure data sharing.
Right. And there are other examples, too. Like, companies like Google and Apple are using differential privacy to collect aggregated data from users while still keeping individual data private.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They use it to figure out things like what features in a software update are popular or how people are using certain apps.
That's really interesting. So they're getting useful information without actually collecting personal details about specific users.
Exactly. It lets them improve their products without compromising anyone's privacy. It's a win-win.
That's great to hear. It's encouraging to see these techniques being put to use in the real world.
What about local differential privacy? Are there examples of how that's being used? LDP is a great fit for situations where you're collecting data from individuals on their own devices. Think about a health tracking app on your phone, like one that collects your heart rate, sleep patterns, or exercise habits.
Okay, yeah, I use apps like that.
LEP could add noise to that data directly on your phone before sending it to the company's servers. That way, they wouldn't be getting your raw, sensitive health data, but they could still gather overall trends about user health.
That makes a lot of sense. It puts users more in control of their data. It's like having a personal privacy shield right there on your phone.
Exactly. And these are just a few examples. As these technologies get better, I think we'll see them being used in all sorts of applications, things like personalized medicine, financial modeling, and even self-driving cars.
The possibilities are endless. But as these technologies become more common, it makes you wonder what we, as individuals, can do to protect our own privacy. Are there any practical steps we can take to be more privacy aware in our everyday lives?
Absolutely. The first step is just being aware. Think about what data you're sharing and who you're sharing it with. Read privacy policies, even though they can be really boring. And pay attention to the permissions you're giving to apps on your phone or computer.
It's so easy to just click agree without even thinking about it.
I know, right? It's important to take a moment to consider what information you're giving away. Another good tip is to minimize your digital footprint. Do you really need to create an account for every website or app you use? And consider using privacy-focused browsers and search engines that don't track your activity.
It's like doing a digital spring cleaning, getting rid of unnecessary data, and being more careful about what you share.
I like that. And don't be afraid to ask questions. If you're not sure how a company is using your data, contact their customer support or privacy team. Use your rights under data privacy regulations like GDPR and CCPA. The more we demand transparency from the companies we give our data to, the more they'll start prioritizing privacy.
It's a reminder that we're not powerless. We have a voice, and we can use it to protect our privacy.
Absolutely. The more people who speak up and demand better privacy, the more things will change for the better.
It sounds like it's a combination of things then. Individual awareness, new technologies, and stronger regulations, all working together to build a more privacy-conscious future.
Exactly. It's a journey we're all on together.
Well said. This deep dive has been incredibly eye-opening for me, and I hope it's been the same for our listeners. We've talked about some complex stuff, but the main point is that this isn't just some technical field for experts. It affects everyone. It's about figuring out how to use data for good while protecting everyone's right to privacy.
You said it perfectly, and I think that's a great place to stop for now. When we come back, we'll look at some specific examples of how these techniques are being used in different areas and talk about what each of us can do to protect our own privacy in this data-driven world.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. It's been a wild ride through the world of privacy-preserving machine learning, and we're ready to wrap things up.
It has been a fascinating journey, for sure. From understanding the threats to privacy in this data-driven age to exploring all these innovative solutions, it's mind-blowing to see how much progress is being made.
It really is. We've covered so much ground: differential privacy, compressive privacy, even delved into cryptography a bit. All these ingenious solutions to protect our privacy.
It's amazing to see the power of interdisciplinary work. You have computer scientists, cryptographers, statisticians, ethicists, and legal experts all coming together to tackle these complex challenges.
It's a true team effort, and it's already leading to real-world applications. We talked about the Data Hub platform, which shows how these techniques can be used for secure data sharing. Will other real-world examples come to mind?
Well, you see companies like Google and Apple using differential privacy to collect data from users without compromising individual privacy.
Like how?
So they use it to learn about user behavior in a general sense, like what features are most popular in a new software update or how people are using certain apps.
So they can improve their products without knowing anything specific about any individual user.
Exactly. They get insights without collecting personally identifiable information. It's a win-win for everyone.
That's fantastic. So differential privacy is being used in the real world. What about local differential privacy, LDP? Are there examples of that?
LDP is perfect for situations where data is collected on people's own devices. Imagine you have a health tracking app on your smartphone, you know, one that tracks things like your heart rate or sleep patterns.
I use a couple of those.
With LDP, the app could add some noise to your data right there on your phone before it's even sent to the company.
So the company wouldn't actually be getting your raw, sensitive health data.
Exactly. But they could still get general insights about health trends.
It's like having that personal privacy shield right on your phone. As these technologies become more widespread, it makes you wonder what we as individuals can do to protect our own privacy. Any practical tips?
Definitely. The first thing is just being aware. Pay attention to what data you're sharing and who you're sharing it with. Take the time to read privacy policies and be mindful of the permissions you give to apps.
It's so easy to just click agree without thinking.
Right. But it's important to pause and consider what information you're giving away and try to minimize your digital footprint. Do you really need an account for every website or app? Look for privacy-focused browsers and search engines that don't track you.
It's like taking control of your digital life, cleaning things up and being more intentional about what you share.
Exactly. And don't be afraid to ask questions. If you're not sure how a company is using your data, contact them. A lot of countries have data privacy laws, like GDPR and CCPA use your rights under those laws. The more we demand transparency and accountability, the better companies will get at protecting privacy.
That's empowering. We're not just helpless bystanders in this data-driven world. We can take action and advocate for our privacy.
Absolutely. And when more people do that, it'll create a ripple effect. It'll push companies to be more responsible and encourage stronger regulations.
So it's a group effort. We need a combination of individual actions, technological advancements, and better regulations to build a more privacy-conscious future.
Exactly. It's a journey we're all on together.
This deep dive has been a real eye-opener. We've covered some complex stuff, but the main takeaway is that this isn't just for tech experts. It's something that affects all of us. Finding that balance between benefiting from data and protecting privacy is crucial.
Well said. And that's a great note to wrap things up on. Thanks for having me on the deep dive. It's been a pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine. And to our listeners, keep those questions coming. We'll be back next week with a deep dive into a whole new topic. Until then, stay curious, stay informed, and stay private.